Next case is 072225, State of Ohio Lake Trail Dillard Department Stores versus Administrative Bureau Workers' Compensation. Mr. Birch.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Mr. Plymail, Ms. Porter. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Birch of the firm of Moskowitz and Troy, and I'm here representing the appellant, Dillard's Department Stores, in this matter. If I may, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This is a mandamus action. It's an appeal of right before this court and concerns Dillard's right to be reimbursed from the Workers' Compensation Surplus Fund for payment of compensation and medical benefits relating to the once allowed but now disallowed claim condition of L4-5 disc bulge. It involves, in my estimation and based on our issues presented to this court, an interpretation analysis of the double dismissal rule in context of 512 appeals, which is the unique appellate structure of the workers' compensation system, and the application of the requirements of Section 4123.65, which is the General Assembly's settlement statute that was enacted or as an amended settlement procedure and put in place in 1993.
Well, the claim wasn't disallowed, though, was it, Mr. Birch?
It was disallowed. It's our position that it was disallowed, Your Honor.
Well, there was a settlement, am I right?
It did settle.
And it was a payment of $15,000.
Correct.
And that was for all claims and the no additional recourse.
The settlement agreement set forth certain terms that were bargained between the self-insured employer and the claimant.
Is it your position then that every settled claim has the adjudicative factor of disallowed?
Not at all. Not at all, Your Honor.
And this distinguishes the facts in this case from all other settlements?
In this particular instance, there was a bargain for term that was provided for in the settlement agreement that was submitted to the Industrial Commission for its approval.
And what term was that?
It was a dismissal with prejudice with a finding that the claimant was not entitled to participate in the workers' compensation fund for the single condition that was on appeal.
But the Bureau was not a party to that.
That's correct.
What difference did it make to the party giving that consideration of a disentitlement to participate?
I'm sorry, what consideration?
Yes.
With the consideration of the party? Well, the plaintiff in this instance bears the burden of proof, as the court knows. The plaintiff in this instance, in this particular case, had a chiropractor who had seen the claimant on one occasion, and as we were on the eve of trial, and mind you, these self-insured appeals are involved with two parties. The Bureau of Workers' Compensation is represented, but they're essentially, they never went to a deposition, they never appeared at a hearing, they didn't participate in any discovery. It's two lawyers.
They didn't sign the settlement agreement.
They're not, the statute does not provide for them to sign the settlement agreement.
The point is that the language that you're speaking about in the settlement agreement didn't affect the claimant, it affected the Bureau.
It affected the claimant as well. The claimant, by forfeiting her right to participate, set herself up for an overpayment, which the Bureau would declare upon the payment of the surplus fund reimbursement.
Why wouldn't every self-insured want to extract that same agreement and collect back all the payments every time from every settlement that they get into?
Well,
and in effect, bankrupt the Bureau.
Well, this is a bargain for term, first of all, and in this particular instance, as I said, given the circumstances of this case, Your Honor, the plaintiff could have shown up for trial and not participated at all. She couldn't have not called her expert. There are any number of ways that this could have been accomplished if she wanted to do this. The plaintiff has complete control over this because she bears the burden of proof. This matter had already been dismissed once. But this isn't something, every claimant's not going to give up this right. In this particular instance, As the statute provides and as the interpretive authorities, self-insured employers under the new statute have wide latitude to settle this matter on terms that are favorable to this. And that was the amendment that was made, and that's what the General Assembly has provided for in the scheme. The only gauge on that is the Industrial Commission's approval, which in this particular instance was given.
Counsel, the claimant in this case gives up, or what does the claimant give up in terms of this particular injury or condition? This condition sounds serious. Now, you make it sound as if it weren't even legitimate, but it had been approved through three levels at the Bureau. So when this is settled, this claimant would not be able to have your company pay for surgery if surgery became necessary later, or anything else for additional disability that flowed out of this injury?
That is correct. She gives up all her rights related to her claim in exchange for the amount of money she was to settle the entire claim, which in this instance was $15,000.
And if your client had lost at the trial, what's the tail on this claim financially to your company?
Well, it really depends on the underlying activity. There hadn't been much activity, to be perfectly frank, in the claim for some time other than this one condition. But the basis for our decision to offer a settlement was because it did involve a middle-aged woman with a low back injury, and we saw future exposure associated with that. So
she wasn't getting any periodic payments?
At that point, she had not received any periodic benefits for some time. They had been cut off for a while.
So the tail on this was unknown. It could have been large or small.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Counsel, the legal issue before us, I think, is whether a settlement complies with the statutory requirement that there be a disposition of the claim by administrative order or by the court. You've argued in your brief why this situation complies with that. Let me hear your strongest argument on
with regard to the compliance with the statute.
Yes.
Well, 4123.65, as the court knows, it involves both self-insured and state-funded employers. In this particular instance, and it applies in this court's prior rulings, in court appeals. In this particular instance, the two parties and the only two parties to a settlement agreement involving an SI claim are the claimant and the self-insured employer. We negotiated terms, which are embodied in that agreement, related to the settlement of the workers' compensation claim on the eve of and in connection with a court appeal, which was then pending. That agreement then was signed by the parties, as is required, and it was submitted to the Industrial Commission of Ohio, and a copy was mailed to the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. Both administrative bodies and Gold Meadow, this court indicated that the administrative safeguards that are in place as prescribed by the legislature in 4123.65 are satisfied by that waiting period, which runs from 30 to 20 days.
So, counsel, it was submitted, and they had the opportunity during that window to object to your settlement with the claimant.
The Bureau could have objected to it. They could have contacted the Industrial Commission. They could have said, we disagree with this. This provides for surplus fund reimbursement. They could have done it.
My understanding from reading the briefs is that there's no question that it was submitted, and there's no question that the time passed, and there's no question that the Bureau sat on its hands and did nothing. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Justice, yes. They did nothing. And then, by operation of law, on the 30th day, it became a final, valid, and approved settlement agreement subject to the completion of the executory provisions of the settlement agreement.
Clarify for me at what point the Bureau knows about the settlement.
The Bureau knows about the settlement when it's provided to them on January 23rd, or 27th, I believe, is when they received it, of 2004. There was a file stamp copy indicated had been received by the Bureau and was in its possession at that time.
What is the legal impact, if any, the trial judge put on a post-dismissal entry that says, in part, this being the case, the court finds no basis for issuing a judgment stating that Scott is not entitled to participate in the fund?
I don't find that to be terribly important to this court's determination. Oh, it's based on a court of appeals decision, which is on appeal before this court, and basically is a tautological. It's because the court of appeals ruled this way, this is the way I'm going to rule. But we're before this court as an appeal of right on an issue which is really for this court to decide, and is really an issue of first impression so far as I can tell.
Counsel, if you had settled this case, let's say for $200,000 instead, and the court had entered the same dismissal entry, saying that not entitled to participate, but you had settled for $200,000. Would that change the scenario? Would you still be entitled to go back to the Bureau and recover all your costs?
Not all my costs. I would only, my costs in this particular instance are limited to those that are involved in the condition that was on appeal and only that condition, because they had been paid through the administrative process based on the allowance.
Well, if you had, in this case, you incurred what, $41,000?
$41,000, correct.
So you settled for $15,000. You incurred $41,000. Let's say you had settled for $200,000. That would imply that she had a legitimate complaint, that you had recognized it and you had settled it. So why would that be entitle you to reimbursement? Because that doesn't really feel at all or sound or seem at all like not participating. It's a settlement to end all of your risks and her risk.
Yes.
But it sure changes the fact pattern, and we have to make law that will affect many different cases. You may have a more sympathetic case because of the low dollar figure, but what's to keep the next company for settling for a high amount but then be able to recover their costs?
Again, Your Honor, this is a bargain for proposition. The statute allows for flexibility in negotiations, which include any manner of things, which in this particular instance happened to include the potential or the ability to apply and the right to obtain reimbursement. But this has to be negotiated between the parties.
Why did you negotiate this where she had to admit that she had no interest or was not entitled to participate? If you're going to get rid of this for $15,000 and cut off any future liability to this former employee, why did you put it? Seems to me $15,000 was a pretty good investment for Dillard's here to pay them off. Why'd you need this language in here?
Why did I need the language? Again, because if this is just settled and dismissed, which is the typical entry,
it gives rise to no
reimbursement rights.
So you did this with a vision towards challenging the status and going back with the reimbursement.
We did this with the express purposes of obtaining surplus fund reimbursement. The settlement agreement embodies that principle and that agreed term.
All right.
The Bureau and the Industrial Commission were aware of that.
Then I'd like to go back to my question, because
sure,
I don't think I got my full answer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It wasn't your fault. When you do this with the deliberate intent to seek reimbursement by putting that language in, what prevents the next company, if we rule your way, from settling for the $200,000, which certainly seems to recognize that there is an issue there, that it's a right to participate, but put that language in so you can go back and seek the reimbursement?
I guess there's two. The first governor on that is there has to be an agreement between the parties. One of the consequences of this is...
Well, the claimant has nothing to lose by putting that in. She's going to get $200,000 and cut off all her risk, and you're going to get your money back. So there's not going to be any inhibition in agreement between the parties with my scenario.
Well, she does have a potential risk, because she would have an overpayment declared, and depending on her age and what her work life is and everything else, an overpayment could very well come back to result in a reduction of her future benefits should she have another workers' compensation claim in the future.
Counsel, you're not claiming, I'm sorry, over here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're not claiming for reimbursement the $15,000 settlement money. You're claiming the amount you paid out to her before there was a settlement. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if you settled for $200,000, but you still had only paid her $41,000 for her injury, you would still only be able to be reimbursed the $41,000, correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I'm only entitled to the $41,000 that had been paid out of the administrative process based upon the allowed condition, which has then been disallowed by the double dismissal of the plaintiff's petition.
Counsel, is the client then open, or the claimant, I should say, subject to having that $41,000, the benefits, her obligation to return those to the Bureau?
The statute does provide for recoupment on a percentage basis from future awards.
But just for future awards. So if she has no future claims from another employer, there is no risk.
That's correct, and that's one of the factors that we balance when this was presented as an option to resolve this matter, yes.
So as a follow-up to Justice Cupp, then, if you had incurred $200,000 in costs during this period of time and you settled for $200,000, you essentially would get your $200,000 back.
That would be an even money proposition if I had paid out $200,000, which was all tied to the condition on appeal, yes. That would be highly unlikely given the speed with which these things proceed, but hypothetically it would be possible.
A serious injury with more damage. So
more medical expenses, yes.
So that we understand the mechanics which underlie all of this but don't really go to the narrow legal issue, from my understanding of your answer to Justice O'Connor's question, the disincentive to the injured worker to sign such a settlement agreement is that this, in your view, entitles you to go back and claim the $41,000. And if you're entitled to the $41,000, then that becomes a recoverable claim against the injured worker from future benefits. Is
right.
that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so there's a $41,000 disincentive to this injured worker in signing off on this agreement.
Which also inures to the benefit of the Bureau in this particular instance, too, because Bureau having paid that out, they're the party who would recoup the money from the injured worker from future benefits.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Birch.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Porter.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. If the court rules in Dillard's favor here, you are doing away, at least in part, with the whole definition of self-insured employer. What would stop any so-called self-insured employer with simply doing what Dillard did here? And that is settling, getting a final settlement before the end of the court case, getting the plaintiff to file a 41A, a second 41A, and then recouping everything out of the Bureau's fund. That's what a fund employer does. And fund employer, the Bureau, insures them.
Well, that does seem to be the problem that this, the floodgates issue of does this encourage every employer to try and
correct
do a settlement and then be able to self-insured employer and then be able to recoup all of those funds. However, if that opens the injured worker to jeopardy for those funds, in addition to losing any ability to recover further for the injury in question, isn't that an enormous break on the notion that this would just be a floodgate?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First of all, any settlement, most settlements that are done this way, have a term in there that says, you know, you forever give up any ability to come back and anything associated with this particular claim. That is enough to say that the claimant can't come back and ask for any more money on the claim. They would be subject to a breach of contract action against them by the employer if they tried to do that. This particular term, by their admission, is put in there specifically so that they can say they got a judgment against or a judgment in their favor so that they can go back and get this reimbursement.
But that's the only reason
for that term.
Ms. Porter, this is a surplus fund reimbursement.
That's correct.
And that fund is set up, is it not, for claims that have been paid that should not have been paid.
Correct. It's a very narrow exception to what we call self-insured. In other words, if you go through the trouble of doing an appeal, going through a trial, or going through a summary judgment, or whatever, and getting a court to actually rule in your favor, then you get that money that you put out back.
Yes.
But it's supposed to be a narrow exception to self-insured. It's not supposed to be a fund that allows a self-insured employer to basically bargain with the state's money.
And so by incorporating a term like that, it permits the employer who's settled the claim to recoup all of the money that it's put in.
Correct.
And was this or was this not forwarded to your office, to the Bureau?
Not to my office. It was forwarded to the Bureau.
For their review? For this?
No. No. The Bureau's only duty when a settlement agreement is forwarded to them is to put it into the claim file. The Industrial Commission's only duty when a settlement is forwarded to them is to review it to make sure it is fair for both parties. Neither the Industrial Commission nor the Bureau in this case had the benefit of the legal counsel of the Attorney General's office because the AAG that was assigned to this case did not know about this settlement until long after the 41A had been filed.
But so the Bureau was not party to the settlement agreement.
No, it was not.
And had no ability
party.
Then to object to the incorporation of this term, excluding the right
That's
to participate.
That's correct. They were not a party. They did not object. And the AAG didn't have because he didn't know about it, did not have the ability to call up the Bureau or call up the IC and say, wait a minute, want to object to this
that
term.
That seems like an excuse that doesn't cut the mustard at all to say, well, your client, didn't tell me about it.
Our client didn't tell us. I think the other side has an obligation to let the attorney for the Bureau know when something like this is going on and when there's a term. Secondly, Your Honor,
Is that what you would have us decide with respect to these matters? That it would seem that we don't want to decide this case and create a disincentive to settlement where settlement is appropriate.
Correct.
And it would also seem that there could be circumstances in which little employers legitimately feel this is a bogus claim. And the claimant's lawyer has pushed this right up to the brink, and when it's time to impanel a jury, they were going to go away, or they were going to make us spend some more money defending this, but we were going to win, and so we pay enough to cover the costs of future litigation, and we're gone. And a provision like this could be wholly appropriate under the right circumstances. So if that were all true, then it comes down to who at the state should know. And the Bureau, your client, was told, the Industrial Commission, another client of the Attorney General, was told. And that they didn't tell their lawyer ought to be their problem.
But, Your Honor, they have no reason to tell the lawyer. They assume in a case where an AAG is assigned that the AAG is being informed by opposing counsel what's going on in the case. And that just wasn't the case here. They did not have the benefit of legal counsel because legal counsel didn't even know that the settlement existed. Secondly, it seems to me that this provision is a void provision to start with. How can private parties, off in a side room, decide what a court is going to rule? They can't.
Well, what was the participation of the attorney for the state, the Attorney General,
in this case? In the settlement?
In this case.
The same participation we usually do in most self-insured cases.
What was it in this case?
In this case, they monitored the filings that were sent to them, and they look out for two things. One, they look out for legal issues that might be of importance to the Bureau or the IC that we need to protect, and they look to protect any fund. In this case, it would have been the surplus fund. But the AAG didn't know to intervene to protect the surplus fund here because he didn't know about the settlement until long after it was final.
So was the state a party in this case?
The state is a party, technically a party, yes. But the AAG normally does not take an active role, unless, again, we need to protect the fund or we need to protect the law.
What do you mean technically a party?
You know, in the caption and all the pleadings and everything, there is a name of an AAG who's there. But usually, except in the unusual case, we don't participate in depositions or trials for a number of reasons. It's not appropriate. We don't have the manpower. There are a number of reasons that we treat them this way. But we are...
Is there an appearance by the Attorney General in this case?
Technically, I believe there was an appearance, but the Attorney General can... assigned Assistant Attorney General can only monitor a case when they're sent the materials they need to monitor. They did not know about the settlement. He did not know about the settlement
until long after
it was finalized.
I'd like to clarify, if I could... The counsel, the attorney, assistant attorney general, was of a particular individual was of counsel as of record in the case.
Correct.
Just as the claimant had attorney as
an
identified person.
Absolutely.
All right. So there was any papers, any documents, any pleadings would normally be sent to all of counsel of record.
That's correct.
And the assertion here is that this particular one, the settlement, was sent to the client, the bureau, but not to the attorney of record?
That is my understanding, yes, Your Honor. That was the problem, is that, yes, technically the bureau had this piece of paper in a file, but they didn't have the benefit of legal counsel. But secondly, I'm not sure that this term would be appropriate in a settlement anyway. How can private parties go off in a side room and decide what a court is going to rule? This court actually had a similar case, XL Incorporated, last summer, in which the party sat down, settled the case, but decided as one of the provisions that the court case would go forward, even though the case was moot. It was settled.
Ms. Porter, under 412365D, the section that says the settlement agreement goes to the Industrial Commission, the staff officer is to look at it. It says that the order, if the officer determines that the settlement agreement is clearly unfair, there's an order to disapprove the agreement.
Correct.
Are you saying that this particular condition, when the staff officer would have looked at it, would not have appeared to be unfair to either party?
I think that's probably true. I mean, it was an amount of money for, you know, what was a claim that had cost about $41,000. They were settling it for $15,000.
And the condition that the plaintiffs say, this is, I'm not entitled to participation in the fund, that this would not have appeared to be unfair to either side.
I don't think so, for the reason that, again, an answer I gave earlier, that most of these settlement agreements have some term saying, you know, that this settles this entire claim with the other side. Mm-hmm. Now, would somebody have thought about the implications of this case by seeing the term that says, you know, that a provision will be sent, or, you know, an entry will come out from the court saying that the claim is disallowed? I don't know whether somebody would have caught that or not. Again, they didn't have the benefit of legal counsel from a litigator who might have thought of that.
But I think that opposing counsel is suggesting that there were 30 days
Correct.
For your client to look at the agreement and to determine whether to object or by operation of law to allow this to go into effect.
That's correct, except, Your Honor, technically the IC in these 512 cases, the IC is not our client.
Right.
It's the Bureau who's our client.
Okay.
The IC acts as another adjudicatory body in this.
And that's part of the problem, to say that this was approved by operation of law, because we have two separate sides.
We have two separate agencies. They're not a monolith. They act separately. In 512 cases, we represent the Bureau. We're not technically, the IC is not our client in a case like that.
Okay. Counsel,
so they wouldn't even have thought probably to call the AAG, even if they had wanted to.
I'm still trying to determine what's the fair and appropriate way to handle this. You have, in response to a variety of questions, established that the Attorney General is a lawyer in the case entitled to notice or entitled to copies of these things that are going on, and the Attorney General didn't get it in this case.
That's correct.
So we could decide it narrowly and say, based on that, stop the music. If you got it, and if you looked at this and said, wait a minute, this is a raid on the fund where we don't think it's appropriate. We disagree because three levels of determination that it is a legitimate claim. Is there anything that you could do to stop it? That is, stop the settlement until that provision is taken out. So say you got timely notice, look at it and say, this is not a fair provision for this case. Do you have the legal ability to stop the settlement until that is deleted?
Not the settlement necessarily, but in fact, what happened here was they submitted a journal entry that said that, you know, the claim is disallowed. And the AAG his attention was drawn to this journal entry that had been submitted to the court, and he said, no, Mr. Judge, please don't sign that.
That's the one that I read earlier that the judge refused to sign.
He refused to sign it because that's when the AAG first became
aware.
And
does that have legal significance in this case?
Sure. I mean, the judge himself, not only did he refuse to sign that judgment entry, but if you read his response to the motion, there was a 60B motion and then a motion from Dillard's. In his response, he flat out said, I did not make a judicial decision disallowing the claim in this case. And they are not a prevailing party. The judge said so. The other thing, Your Honor, I think...
Well, counsel, that's, I think, an important aspect, at least in my mind, that these parties cannot negate the effects of the legal process up to the point where they find themselves signing a settlement agreement unless all parties to the legal process would agree to that.
I think that's appropriate. I think that's absolutely appropriate.
But which is not really any new law.
Right, exactly. I think that what needs to happen, at least, at the very least, is that the AAG needs to be able to monitor. And again, one of the reasons we monitor self-insured cases is to protect the fund. The AAG has to be in the position to be able to say, no, I'm not going to allow you to raid the fund in this way unless you do it the right way.
Are you finished? Yeah. I'm sorry. Isn't that a matter of the Attorney General advising the Bureau of Workers' Compensation to don't put these just in the file? Let us know if you get one of these settlement offers.
That is a possibility, Your Honor.
Legal issue for us to decide, certainly. That doesn't bear on the legal issue here. It's how this case is sort of confounded with the facts, but that's an administrative matter.
It is certainly tied up with an administrative matter, but I think the legal issue in this case is did the Bureau abuse its discretion in denying this 65 so-called Cisco reimbursement in this case? And the answer is it did not abuse its discretion because there was not a judicial determination that the claim was disallowed. They tried to manufacture one, but it doesn't exist.
Is 5.112H, is that an important section of the code?
Absolutely.
Well, it says administrative or judicial action.
Correct.
And what counsel, the appellant means, says the Industrial Commission signed off on it.
That's not the kind of administrative action they're talking about. I think what they're saying is if the Bureau allows a claim and the employer appeals that into the Industrial Commission and the Industrial Commission at some level disallows the claim, that would allow Cisco reimbursement as well. And in the Kokosing case, that was the case where it was appealed up into the Industrial Commission before you got to the court, and it was reversed at that point. And in that case, the employer is allowed to have reimbursement from the fund.
If we resolve this case by saying that because the AG is a party, they have to be notified and have a chance to object to any proposed entry like they did in the second case, there may be some cases where you would approve the entry. You might think that is a fair resolution and agree. It's not necessary that you're going to disagree to all of them, is it? It's that you want the opportunity to evaluate it and determine whether this is a subterfuge to get reimbursement when they're actually settling a legitimate claim.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and try and figure out a fact situation, you know, one way or the other, because I don't know. But yes, certainly one thing that needs to happen is that the AAG needs to know when one of these settlements is going forward and whether it has a term like this that would trigger Cisco reimbursement so that we can evaluate whether it's appropriate or not.
So what is your response as to the proposition of law presented on a second 41A notice of dismissal operating as an adjudication on the merits, which is the legal issue
right
that we brought the case in on?
The reason that in this case that a second 41A does not act as an adjudication on the merits is because by the time the second 41A was filed, there were no merits left to adjudicate. The case had been settled. It was over. It was done with.
So this case was resolved by virtue of settlement, not
correct,
by virtue of the 41A dismissal.
Correct.
In your view.
So, I mean, yes, exactly right. It was settled. It was gone. There was no case or controversy. Again, like the Excel case from last summer that I talked about,
right,
it was moot. There was no case or controversy. The 41A was really just to get it off the book, the court's books, so that they could close the case and close the court's docket.
Thank
no legal effect as an adjudication.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Mr. Birch, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Please, court.
Would you have any problem with a clear pronouncement from this court that these type of settlements where you're going to propose such an entry need to get actually served on the Attorney General and have a chance, not the Bureau or the Industrial Commission, but the attorney who can look at the legal ramifications of such an entry?
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes down to the strict construction of 4123.65 makes no provision for that. This is not a new phenomenon for the Bureau, and they're standing up here talking about floodgates being opened by this is disingenuous. This has been going on for a long time, and there's part the record reflects that. This is a unique situation, and it's only in a particular situation where this would even give rise to being a bargaining term.
What's this has been going on for a long time? I don't understand.
They have paid. Their matters have been resolved with findings where there has been a determination as part of a settlement term where the plaintiff claimant has been entitled not to participate in the fund, and they have paid Cisco reimbursement at the same time the matter has been settled. And that there was testimony and a finding made in the Court of Appeals opinion to that effect.
Was the Attorney General party to those?
Yes. Yes, these are courts.
But just not here.
Not in this particular, because this instance involves a 41A1 dismissal, and they make a big deal about a decision, but it's judicial action, and by its nature, a second dismissal is an adjudication, and it says that the word the statute uses is determination.
When you say the case is first impression, it's first impression because in this case, there wasn't an Attorney General representing the Bureau authorizing the payment and then the reimbursement back to your client. In all the other cases, there are.
No, in this particular instance, those cases are handled the exact same way. The Attorney General was present here. The Attorney General knew about the entry that we submitted and did nothing until 6 months after the 41A dismissal had been entered, and then tried to reopen the case, and then indicated in the brief that this gives rise to Cisco reimbursement, and I need to get back in the case. And prior to that time, Your Honor, they had done nothing. We took the depositions. We attended the pretrials. Plaintiff was the one who bore the expense of having to go to trial. Plaintiff has complete control over this because she bore the burden of proof in this instance. The Attorney General did nothing. And they were provided with all the legal proceedings, but the statute is specific as to what, and this court has found in Gold Medal and in the Wise case that was decided last year at this time, that strict adherence to that statute is required.
Now, the Attorney General claims that they did not get the proposed entry, till after it had been filed.
They did get the entry, and they also
got it before or after it was filed?
The dismissal entry? They got the dismissal entry at the same February 18th is when they received it, or whenever it was.
Before or after it was filed?
Before or after it was filed?
Yes.
I imagine it would have been contemporaneous because it was mailed. It was mailed from Cleveland, and it was
filed.
They would actually
have gotten it after it was filed if you filed it and mailed it at the same time.
Well, he mailed it on February 13th. It was filed with the court on February 18th, and the Attorney General's office either got it on the 17th or the 18th, Your Honor.
Counsel, in terms of the real-life practice, assume, and you can correct these assumptions if they're wrong, that it's not that easy to get plaintiff's counsel for the injured party to agree to this particular provision. It would also seem to me, I can't imagine a circumstance in which the Attorney General, if they have the ability to block it, would ever agree to this position, because 100% of the time their client would not want something that is an automatic to be reimbursed out of the fund.
Your Honor, it's to answer your first question, it's rare, but it, you know, there are circumstances I've indicated where a plaintiff would agree to this. And as to the second, I have, in situations just within the last 6 months, presented to an Attorney General a situation similar to this and received their approval.
Okay.
Not that I needed it, but I received it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Birch.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.